Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, September 8th, 2016. Last night, in a warm-up for the three presidential debates, Clinton and Trump took questions from Matt Lauer. The morning after, it's Matt Lauer who's getting bashed. So I watched this with some interest. It was sponsored by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, Paul Rykoff's group, and it had good intentions, and the brightest moments were the 3 minutes out of the hour when veterans were given the microphone and allowed to question the candidates. But overall, it was another exercise in media malpractice, in my opinion, because there were so many questions that did not get asked. There were so many answers that didn't get well-deserved follow-up questions like, what the hell are you talking about? And the net effect is to just kind of reinforce impressions that already exist. And I want to credit Andrew Bacevich. He is the retired history professor and author of numerous books. His latest is called America's War for the Greater Middle East. I taped an interview with him today that I'll be releasing next Monday. And he was actually there in New York for the presentation last night. It was not a debate. It was a serial questioning of the two candidates. And he noted that nothing was raised about a path to peace. Nobody talked about how we can work for peace, how we can bring peace, for example, to the Palestinians and Israelis or to other war-torn countries. And fundamentally, the idea that war is normal, that war is the obvious response to the challenges faced, that was a given. And I thank Professor Bacevich for pointing that out. There was also no question about the Clinton Foundation. There were no questions about drone strikes, about the creeping missions in North Africa. There was discussion about Libya, and I think that was worthwhile. And there were also some interesting takeaways. Hillary Clinton flatly said, "We are not putting ground troops into Iraq ever again, and we're not putting them into Syria." Now, this is the clearest separation from her hawkish advocacy as Secretary of State that we have seen. And I welcome it if we can believe it. What was not so credible was Matt Lauer spent about almost half of the session with Hillary Clinton jousting over the email scandal. Now, I think it's a critical issue, and particularly for military members who had to honor their security clearances. That's where one of those questions came from. But he talked around the issues. He let her advance a whole new explanation that, oh, I had a separate system for classified communications. She's never raised that particular excuse before. And I was not really persuaded by the arguments she made about how she used her email server and the way that Matt Lauer failed to follow up. He didn't ask a single question about the nexus between the Clinton Foundation and her work at the State Department, as evidenced by the meetings with Crown Prince of Bahrain and others who were big donors to her husband's foundation. Nope, that didn't come up at all. And as we'll get to in a moment, the commentary the day after is that Matt Lauer was much tougher with Hillary Clinton than with the evasive and slippery Donald Trump. And I will say that Trump is a very difficult person to interview. I haven't done it, but I can put myself into that position, having interviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of people, including many political candidates over the years. But once again, Trump had one moment where I said, I agree with that. Only one. It's when, in a question, Matt Lauer inferred that it is a fact that Russia hacked the DNC servers. And Trump correctly pointed out, nobody knows that. But that was the only truthiness moment I saw from Trump, because he was dodging questions, he was evasive, He made a pledge not to bash Hillary, and then he bashed her and bashed her and bashed her again. And the most remarkable thing he said, I took some notes. He said that we should have taken the oil when we occupied Iraq. And that if we had, it would have prevented the rise of the Islamic State because they have used oil to fund their mythical caliphate. Donald, the oil they got was from Syria. And Donald, the idea that, to the victor goes the spoils, he tried to summon that quote and kind of mangled it. It's a little late for that. And Trump was trying to rewrite history, blaming Obama for executing Bush's exit plan from Iraq. And that's something I discussed with Colonel Basevich that you'll be able to hear in the interview when it comes out next week. Then, of course, there were the issues about Putin. And Trump loves to brag about how Putin has called Trump brilliant. And Trump, says that while he's happy to take the compliment, it doesn't mean that he won't negotiate hard with Vladimir Putin. But then he went on to basically compare him to Obama, saying that Putin's favorable ratings in the polls in Russia are so much greater than Obama's, and that he's a forceful leader, unlike Obama. Well, I don't think those are particularly valuable comments, and I don't think they're particularly accurate, as we will get to here in a moment. But Trump also said that he wants some new generals if he's president because Obama has reduced them to rubble. Rubble? All right. Okay. Now, why did NBC deploy Matt Lauer when they've got some better political reporters? And better is not to say they are great, but I think Chuck Todd is a better political interviewer than Matt Lauer is. And Lauer showed in his unwillingness to follow up on some of the questions that I've already raised and on a few other issues. He also used questions where he, said that Russia had invaded Ukraine, and I can't remember the exact word he used to say that it had taken control of Crimea. But those are much more complicated issues than Matt Lauer's question would suggest. And, for example, Hillary Clinton, who had to go first because she lost the coin toss, in her comments she said that Trump has tried to say that he didn't support the war in Iraq, and she cited a Howard Stern interview. Can you imagine Hillary Clinton listening to Howard Stern interview Donald Trump? Well, she probably didn't. She read a transcript that a subordinate brought to her. But, it's factually correct. He did support the war until about 2004 when he decided he wasn't for it. And so Hillary is correct about that. But during the separate interview with Trump, Trump just said, I was totally against the war in Iraq, and Matt Lauer didn't utter a peep. Now, because Candy Crowley, or Crowley, got brushed back for correcting error-riddled statements by Mitt Romney back in 2012, some of these anchors are probably told by their bosses, don't correct him. No, don't do that. You'll end up like Candy Crowley. So, one of the other bizarre things was in the issue related to sexual harassment in the military, Lauer did dig up an old tweet from Trump a few years back, 2013, where he said that sexual assaults were a logical result of men and women serving together in the military. And that suggests he wants to roll back that policy and eliminate women from the military. He didn't say that in any detail. He simply acknowledged the tweet and said, it is a correct tweet. All right. Now, here are a few other omissions by Matt Lauer last night. When Hillary Clinton explained her anti-ISIS plan by saying we are not going to have ground troops in Iraq, Lauer failed to mention that we already do have troops. And Clinton herself acknowledged that there are a few thousand, but she described them as special forces and commandos, and made this distinction that, you know, we won't have large deployments in the future in Iraq and Syria if she is president. And this critique from The Intercept notes that in the total hour with both candidates, the elapsed time given to taking questions from four veterans in the audience, I'm sorry, a total of 10 veterans in the audience, four who said they supported Clinton and six who say they support Trump, they only gave them 3 minutes. And so Matt Lauer did dominate this presentation, this interview, sequential interview program. And I just think that it was a very weak choice. And also the show should have been longer because there are so many issues. They didn't really get the candidates' positions on the wars in Iraq and Syria. And Trump was asked a softball by Lauer. Hey, did you get that security briefing? And I know you can't tell us anything about it, but tell us something about it. And he proceeded to offer this vague innuendo that his security briefing educated him that President Obama and Hillary Clinton had defied the commanders, the military, or the intelligence community. He wasn't explicit. And that it was a huge, huge, huge blunder. A disaster, as he likes to say. So, all in all, it is a bit of a preview, kind of a preseason warm-up for the debates that start on September 26th. And I did require a shower after I watched. Now, in the fallout this morning, Hillary Clinton derided Trump's praise of Putin as unpatriotic and scary. Quote, bizarrely, once again, he praised Russia's strongman, Vladimir Putin, even taking the astonishing step of suggesting that he prefers the Russian president to our American president. Now, that is not just unpatriotic and insulting to the people of our country, as well as to our commander-in-chief. It's scary. Well, I don't know, Hillary. Do we have to put all this in terms of fear? I mean, you can call it stupid, you can call it naive. There are many things. But is it really scary? And this fits into the whole Democratic message point that's been embraced by Nancy Pelosi and others, and Harry Reid, Russians hacked the DNC servers. Yesterday I reported to you that Pelosi has challenged her counterpart, Speaker Paul Ryan, not to use the proceeds, the product of the hacking, in political campaigns this year. And curiously, Paul Ryan distanced himself from Trump's remarks, accusing Putin of conducting state-sponsored cyber attacks on what appears to be the U.S. political system. So Paul Ryan's jumping on board the Russia bashing. And his quote is, Vladimir Putin is an aggressor who does not share our interests. Putin is violating the sovereignty of neighboring countries. He is acting like an adversary. And here's a really weird statement from Clinton. What would Ronald Reagan say about a Republican nominee who attacks America's generals and heaps praise on Russia's president? She says, I think we know the answer. But who cares what Ronald Reagan would have said? Now, one actual fact that Donald Trump interjected into his commentary last night is that just the other day, a Russian fighter jet that was shadowing an American surveillance plane over the Black Sea got so close that the report is it came within 10 feet of the American P-8 Poseidon surveillance plane. Our officials say that at one point during the 19-minute interception, the planes came within 10 feet of each other. Now, at those speeds, that is really dangerous, I have to say. This occurred on September 7th, and the Kremlin issued this statement. The U.S. surveillance airplanes tried to approach the Russian border twice. He added that the planes were flying with their transponders off. They were dark in military parlance. And we're told that that's fairly common, that spy planes turn off their transponders. And a civilian website that accesses aerial radars around the globe, flightradar24.com, said that it didn't pick up either the American surveillance plane or the Su-27 fighter jet that almost collided with it. So this is another, you know, provocative move. We've seen this quite a bit. There are almost a dozen incidents in recent years. And, of course, we always blame the Russians. But that plane was running surveillance over Crimea, which Russia now claims as its own. And if you want to dispute that claim, then that's a whole different conversation. But the U.S. is acting provocatively and then saying, oh, those big bad Russians, look, they almost hit one of our planes that was flying in there, in their airspace, or at least in disputed airspace. I'll modify it to that. Trevor Tim has an interesting op-ed published at The Guardian today entitled, Almost Everyone Gets Russia Wrong Apart from Obama. He opens, these days it's en vogue in Washington to be itching for conflict with Russia. Politicians and pundits alike are outdoing each other for how they can describe the supposed threat Putin now poses to the West. In a little notice comment last week, Clinton suggested that the U.S. should start preparing military responses to cyber attacks allegedly perpetrated by Russia on the DNC. And her campaign has also spent the last few weeks ratcheting up the fear-mongering that the Trump campaign is secretly a Russian plant of some sort. Tim continues, increasing military tensions with Russia is now a bipartisan issue. Republicans, not named Donald Trump, spent much of the primary earlier this year calling for a no-fly zone in Syria and were perfectly willing to shoot down Russian planes over the region. Meanwhile, House Democrats called on the FBI to investigate the unknown links between the Trump campaign and Russia, and the media largely seems to be eager to portray Putin as an 11th-dimensional chess grandmaster who is behind every major world event. He notes that recently Secretary of Defense Ash Carter opened ratcheting up the tension with Russia. And he made some comments that were quoted a couple of days ago. So Tim then says, Obama's been generally right about Russia for years. In a 60 Minutes interview last year, correspondent Steve Croft kept trying to get Obama to admit that Putin was asserting his dominance over the U.S., but Obama calmly explained, what Russia is doing in Syria and Ukraine is not born out of strength, but out of desperation. Well, that may or may not be the case, but I do agree that Obama is not taking the bait and trying to foment conflict with Russia, as others are, including Hillary Clinton. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And, you know, we're now available on YouTube. The Daily News and Comment podcast is on a YouTube channel. And I think we're very close to having enough subscribers that we're going to be able to change the URL. So it'll be YouTube/Peter B. Collins or something like that. We'll probably have that up next week. In the meantime, I have included the temporary link to the YouTube channel. It's in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. And if you go to my channel and click on subscribe and get notifications, you'll get notified in your YouTube box each time there's a new podcast. And for many people, this is an easier way to get the podcast, maybe easier for you than iTunes or the TuneIn channel. And I'm happy to make that available. So this is your opportunity to support my work by becoming a subscriber. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. And you click on the menu button, then it pulls down, you get become a subscriber, that takes you to the sign-up page. And some great people have done this and supported me for years. People like Janet Price, Grant Gibson, the estimable Faith Peoples, and Terry Paris, too. I'm grateful to each and every one of you, and I invite you to become a subscriber. As I mentioned, I have only one copy of Revolution's End, the powerful book about the SLA and the Patty Hearst kidnapping, and it goes to the first person who takes out a new annual subscription and gives me a mailing address in the continental U.S. Well, Jason Leopold, the FOIA junkie who works for Vice News, got a hold of an FBI memo written by Director Comey that was published yesterday. And he didn't have to use FOIA to get it. Well, apparently it was leaked to CNN, and maybe that's how Jason got a copy. But James Comey is tired of talking about Hillary Clinton's damn emails. And he wrote a two-page memo described by Jason as highly defensive to FBI employees that was distributed yesterday. And he said, yeah, I'm going up on the Hill later this month, and I want to tell them about all the great work the FBI is doing, but I'm sure that they're going to focus mostly on the Clinton email investigation. So Comey writes, despite all the chest beating by people no longer in government, there really wasn't a prosecutable case against Clinton or her aides. I find this very hard to believe. The hard part, he noted, was deciding whether the FBI should be transparent about why the Bureau reached its decision. Quote, you may be sick of this, but let me leave you with a few words about how I've been describing the email investigation in private to our former employees. I don't know why he cites that. As I meet them around the country, I explain to them that there are two aspects to this, our judgment about the facts and prosecutive merit, and two, how we decided to talk about that judgment. I tell them that the difficult decision was the second part, not the first. At the end of the day, the case itself was not a cliffhanger. No, it was not. It was a pretty slam dunk that there should have been a prosecution, Mr. Comey. He said in his FBI memo that anyone taking such suggestions either doesn't know us or they are full of baloney and maybe some of both. I have no patience for suggestions that we conducted ourselves as anything but what we are, honest, competent, and independent. I can't believe that he really believes any of that. I want to thank Sean Westmoreland. He served in our military, and he is now serving as a whistleblower about America's drone program. And he and two other veterans have filed what's called an amicus brief in support of a lawsuit brought by a man from Yemen who now lives in Canada, who lost two family members in a drone strike in Yemen in 2012. And this man's name is Faisal bin Ali Jaber. For 4 years, he has been seeking accountability. He was handed $100,000 in $100 American currency to buy his silence and as a death bounty for the killing of his, I think it's a brother and a brother-in-law. And he has kept that money in the sealed package. He doesn't want blood money. He simply is asking for an apology and steps to prevent drone strikes that kill innocent civilians in the future. So the amicus brief is a 17-pager signed by Sean Westmoreland, a former Air Force technician who I've interviewed and was very honest about his misgivings about the drone program, and two of his former colleagues. And Westmoreland said, people have the right to know how a screw-up can lead to the death of their family members. This is about accountability, transparency, and how we as a military can learn from our mistakes. So I'm pleased to see this, and Sean, thanks for sharing the information in an email earlier today. I've just learned through a new report written by Bill Hartung of the Center for International Policy. He is a highly respected analyst and critic of the military-industrial complex. The last book he wrote that I interviewed him for was about Lockheed Martin. And he reports that the Obama administration, since 2009, has offered to sell $115 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia. Now, recently, we offered them 150 M1A2 Abrams battle tanks for a little over $1 billion. Hartung says those are principally intended to replenish the Saudi arsenal depleted in the war in Yemen. So we are enabling the continuation of the conflict in Yemen that is largely fronted by the Saudis because we continue to restock their arsenals. $57 billion of the 115 has already been executed. And this is a sorry standard. But the U.S. is the world's biggest arms merchant, and we sell weapons to the most repressive regimes on the planet. And I want to credit Ted Lieu, Democratic congressman from Southern California, who is rallying forces to block any further arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Now, he said, and I don't agree with the first part, I don't oppose assisting the country of Saudi Arabia, a longstanding ally of the United States. And here I'm in full agreement with Lieu going forward. What I do fundamentally oppose is continuing to sell arms to a military coalition that has repeatedly committed war crimes. The Saudi-led coalition has killed children, patients, doctors, newlyweds. A significant number of the killings of civilians by the Saudi coalition were nowhere near military targets. I will continue to do all that I can to see that the U.S. offers no support to Saudi Arabia's operations in Yemen. And 64 members of the House joined me last week in signing a letter to that effect. Well, let's give Jill Stein credit. She's got some balls. Yesterday, she and her vice presidential candidate, Ajamu Baraka, showed up in Morton County, North Dakota. And you could make a joke before this that Jill Stein is so unknown in Morton County, North Dakota, that she couldn't even get arrested. Well, she hasn't been arrested, but a warrant has been issued because in support of the protesters of the Dakota Access Pipeline, she was handed a can of spray paint and she tagged a bulldozer with the statement, "I approve this message." And Baraka painted the word decolonization on a piece of construction equipment, earning him an arrest warrant from the Morton County Sheriff. Good on you. And yesterday I mentioned that musician Charlie Pierce from Austin, Texas, has been supporting the Native Americans in North Dakota by pushing back on a pipeline billionaire who's been involved in the folk music scene in Texas. And they are now focusing on a guy named Jimmy LaFave. He's got a show next week at Shady Grove in Austin next Thursday night. And they are planning an action there to send a message to Jimmy LaFave. And Charlie writes, LaFave sits on the advisory board for the Woody Guthrie Music Folk Festival. This is an abomination. My hope is this action will bring additional media attention to the Trans-Pecos Pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline, which are both Energy Transfer Partners projects. The desecration of sacred burial grounds and the very real threat to the Missouri River that the Dakota Access Pipeline poses, coupled with the violent attacks on peaceful water protectors, is another shameful chapter in American history. This is just the beginning of a much larger movement, and I believe that as the largest Native American protest in U.S. history continues to grow, there will be a shift in our consciousness. Thank you, Charlie. And as I mentioned, he is the singer and songwriter who fronts Choctaw Wildfire, and they're a good band. Check them out. Also, the New York Times has finally published a story on this protest. Now, I can't say that they have done nothing. I didn't do a search to see that there's been zero coverage, but I do go to the Times website every day, and I get the print edition 3 days a week. So I can safely say that I have not seen any prior coverage by the New York Times. And to their credit, they put it into context with the battle over the Owyhee Dam along the Missouri River, and that protest by Native American families goes back 50 years. And they say that past has now become a poignant backdrop to protests over the $3.7 billion oil pipeline project that would cross just north of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribes Reservation and plunge under a dammed section of the Missouri River. So I credit the Times for putting this in important context and covering it. Toward the end of the story, they even mentioned that Jill Stein was there yesterday. So glad to see you catching up over there at the Gray Lady. Now, I am not a big sports fan, as you know. I don't cover the NFL. But I have been pleased by the protest launched by Colin Kaepernick, the second-string quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, who won't stand during the national anthem. He sat one time, he knelt down another time, and now it is spreading. And Colin Kaepernick was an unlikely instigator of this wave of protest. But I'll take it. I think it's really interesting. So now, the members of the Seattle Seahawks have not announced an explicit plan, but some of them are considering making a protest of their own before their NFL opener against Miami on Sunday. And they claim that whatever happens, the entire team is going to do it. According to linebacker Bobby Wagner, he said, "Nothing's been decided, but anything we want to do, it's not going to be individual, it's going to be a team thing. That's what the world needs to see." Like I say, I'm not a big NFL fan, but I think I'll instruct my DVR to tape that game on Sunday and see what happens. And finally today, I have often described the police department across the bay from me in Oakland, California, as rogue. And it's not just my opinion. They've been under federal court receivership for over 10 years. And the scandals just keep coming and coming and coming. And now we have seen that 4 officers have been fired. 7 were suspended yesterday. And they are 11 of a total of 29 officers from multiple police agencies in the East Bay who all reportedly had sex, perhaps on a repeated basis, with a girl who is known as Celeste Guap. We're pretty sure that's not her real name. That's an assumed name or a prostitute's name. Now, she was underage, 17, when she started stooping cops. And it's a very weird case because her mother is a dispatcher with the Oakland Police Department. So that's how she got to know these cops. And apparently she used Facebook and her well-endowed upper body to attract these officers. And at this point, it's really hard to know who exploited whom. We're not sure if the cops paid for the sex or if they provided her with protection and she provided them with sex in exchange for that. Celeste Guap was last reported in an altercation at a rehab facility in Florida last week. This scandal led to a comedy of errors as we had 3 Oakland police chiefs named and resigned in a 1-week period when this scandal broke a couple of months ago. And just when you think things are starting to improve and the cops have turned a corner in Oakland, things like this pop up. Thanks for joining me today for my free news and comment podcast. It is available on YouTube. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until